It is 1 o'clock. I'll call this meeting to order. This is the meeting of the emergency meeting of the Arizona Board of Chiropractic Examiners. And may we get a roll call, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Angela Powell?
Present.
Dr. George Camacho?
Present.
Dr. Kevin Lees?
Present.
Mr. Mitchell Turbinson? He's just connected. Mr. Turbinson, are you present?
He's muted.
Yes, I'm here.
And Dr. Wade Bennett?
I'm present. And with that, we have all board present. That's great. Before we turn to the single item of business on the agenda today, I want to congratulate board staff on finally working through the event that was the Thinsha transition to the point of having the final piece in place in the form of the wallet feature. This has been an unbelievably difficult task. It has put pressure on everybody. And I just want to commend the staff for having performed under very, very difficult circumstances that were outside of their control and performed in a nothing less than heroic fashion. So thank you very much and well done.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate that. Thank you.
So the purpose of today's board meeting is to review, discuss, and deliberate with regard to the content of the language of proposed Senate Bill 1250. Moments before the beginning of this meeting, I was notified that there may have been some revisions to that since the last time we met. So for the record, the version that we will be reviewing is the one that was available to me until I still don't have a copy of the revision. So what we'll be reviewing is the document that we've had presented to us up until this point in time. And just by way of background, you will recall that in our initial board meeting of this year of 2024, we had prioritized the review of needed changes in statute and rule that we had all kind of noticed and taken note of during the course of administering our jobs, doing our duties as members of the board of directors. And we spent a great deal of time at the last meeting coming up with a comprehensive list, a rather lengthy list of recommended revisions of both statute and rule. Last on the 20th, Monday, last Monday the 22nd, we met with Senator Shamp, the AAC lobbyist, and a team of other lobbyists who were employed by Collision Chiropractic to be briefed on the content of Senate Bill 1250. It was a rather lengthy meeting that consisted almost entirely of just being briefed on the changes, which all of you have had the opportunity to review this information, and you know that it is extensive. And so, as you might well imagine, we spent most of our time just listening and trying to clarify. Our response was, well, we'll review this and respond. And my initial thoughts at that time, I let those present know that about our previous meeting that we had partaken or undertaken at the beginning of the year relative to identifying legislative priorities and with regard to statute and rule changes. My thought originally was, well, perhaps we can, you know, blend what's going on and combine efforts. And so with that in mind, I read through the proposed language, and because of the fact that I encountered many serious issues with the language, it's quite clear to me that we're not going to be blending any proposed legislative effort with this in its current form. Since that time, we have learned that the bill is scheduled to be heard on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, which of course accelerates the necessity of our timeline here and the urgency of us addressing this issue, hence the emergency nature of this meeting. And just as a side note, I had the opportunity, because I wanted to check for universality of certain points, there are a number of revisions that are proposed that are appear to be major revisions of what are generally almost universally accepted practices of the regulation of chiropractic. And so I referred to the Model Practice Act, which is published by the Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Board, who services all licensing boards in the United States, all the provinces in Canada, and in several other foreign countries. And they have a document called the Model Practices Act. And so I compared these changes to the Model Practices Act, and in even a quick run through, I counted 32 variances from the Model Practice Act. We have a bit of work to do to address this, especially these very significant deviances. We've also had a request from Senate staff on a position statement relative to this bill, which is very appropriate. It is typically what is done and is something we need to do. Unfortunately, we have a very limited amount of time in which to respond, and we have a great deal of information to respond about. So our goal today will be to prioritize the key points of that position statement and get as much done as we can in terms of refining what our position should be relative to these matters and moving forward. I want to remind everybody that this is an open meeting, and it is my preference to keep our deliberations relative. You know, there are a lot of legal issues relating to this. And so while we do have the opportunity to go into executive session as appropriate, I want to just sort of set the precedent that we want to keep this as open to the public, make our deliberations as clear as possible and available to the public. And because we have a lot to review, and in contradiction to the time I've just taken to set the stage here, I will appreciate brevity as we move forward in this matter. And so with that, let's get started.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me. Just for the record, I think when you began, you said the bill SB 1250 and this is 1233. Is it not?
I'm sorry.
Just for the record.
Those numbers. I've been looking at several pieces of legislation. So yes,
okay.
Please.
All right.
Thank you for that clarification. okay. And I would like to begin the deliberations on more of a global nature on first a global issue, and then secondly on a key point of interpretation of the law. The first of which is that a great number of the changes in proposed in this legislation transfer content from rule to statute, thus having the effect of moving the administration or the authority away from the board in terms of creating its own rules with an opportunity to do so and putting them into statute, which increases the, in order to make a change or a revision, it requires, you know, legislative option or a legislative process in order to execute. And my feeling about this is it's a mistake in and of itself. Our whole government system is based upon, you know, small government and allowing for the boots on the ground in these regulatory bodies to recognize change as it moves forward and have the ability to be dynamic. In fact, that's the whole reason why we had our planning session last time, to embrace that opportunity and to make the revisions that are appropriate to be made. It's been some time since a number of these things have even been addressed. And we recognize that. And we would not have that ability in many of the cases if this precedent were to be established of moving this language from rule to statute. It is contrary to the protocols that are practiced in every other healthcare regulatory board that I'm familiar with, both in our state and in other states. And so it's a dangerous precedent that I want to call everyone's attention to. It's, I believe, inappropriate. Second point, any comments on that, on that point, by the way?
Agreed.
Okay. Secondly, Alyssa, you will recall that a point was brought up during our meeting with Senator Schamp and the rest of their team relative to the position that they've taken in this proposed legislation is that the board should not be investigating matters or to, the board should immediately cease from investigating matters and refer if there's any possibility of civil or criminal involvement. is that a correct your perception of that position?
Yes, that is my my understanding. Yes.
Okay. And the point that was brought up was the question of whether or not it was our obligation to do that when and just for the benefit of everybody here, let's be an example would be we're proceeding through our investigation and we're investigating something that is specifically within our scope of practice and our scope of jurisdiction and our responsibility to investigate, and in the process encounter some evidence of malfeasance that may be a criminal matter. Point of, I guess, law that was brought to my attention was that there can be only one prosecutorial authority. Is that the right term? I don't know. And that was the justification for the board's obligation to cease and desist on their investigation and then simply, you know, defer that process and stop investigating what they're supposed to be doing. And that's what this language calls for. And so I would direct my question to our Assistant Attorney General, Mr. Hutchison, with regard to that point. What is our obligation? What are the rules and statutory language relative to that issue?
Sure. So the board already has a mandatory reporting statute criminal.
Right. But I think what Dr. Bennett's question is, and maybe is that we don't have prosecutable authority, right? Which means we don't have jurisdiction over the criminal code, right? So we're not adjudicating cases under the criminal code, only what's inside our statutes and rules. And so, I think what he's trying to clarify is that we're still operating in our lane under our authority and not necessarily impeding another investigation.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So the board obviously doesn't prosecute crimes. The board investigates and regulates the practice of chiropractic. But there's no reason why those two things can't be happening at the same time. They don't interact with each other.
So we could be conducting an investigation and make aware the Attorney General's office that a crime may potentially be taking place. They can conduct their own investigation and we continue to pursue what we're doing, which is within the scope of what we're supposed to do, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And their investigation is going to be, you know, a lot of times they're going to be looking for completely different things because they have criminal statutes that they have to be able to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. They're looking for the elements of the crime, not necessarily what the board is tasked with looking at under the Practice Act.
Right.
So is it safe to say that we are not required or obliged to cease any ongoing legal investigation under our authority and, in fact, would be, per our job, obliged to continue with that investigation? Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Okay, just for the record. So at this point, we have a list of our staff has prepared a list of concerns relative to this matter. And unless there's an objection, and I'm certainly, this is kind of an open discussion, and if there's anything anybody wants to particularly bring up, I'm happy to accommodate that. But I do know that the staff have put in a great deal of time and effort in conjunction with the AG's office in kind of stating what their primary concerns are. And because there are so many, I would like to kind of focus on the larger ones to begin with. So unless there's an objection to that, is there?
No.
No, hearing none, then Ms. Vanderveen, would you please begin to summarize your concerns?
So I really tried to focus on patient safety. So in this bill and going through it, and I went line by line, I took our entire current unprofessional conduct rule and the current statutory violations and matched it up to what's currently in SB 1233. And I found that it removed 26 patient safety provisions that already exist and that we utilize pretty significantly to protect the public, which is our mission. And the one of the first ones that I would like to point out to you, it completely strikes from our unprofessional conduct, providing substandard care due to intentional or negligent act or failure to act, regardless whether actual injury to the patient is established. This would no longer be a violation under our statutes. The next one I would like to point out is malpractice. Any cases of malpractice would no longer be a violation of unprofessional conduct. And then I think that this is even more concerning. It strikes our statute 32924A15, which is any conduct or practice contrary to the recognized standards in chiropractic, or any conduct or practice that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of the patient or the public, or any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and skillfully practice chiropractic. This is completely stricken, and a lot of times this is so important. Plus, this is the board's mission. This is literally why the board exists, is to protect the public. And we would have no ability to do that under this new law.
Ms. Vanderveen and Mr. Hutchison, do you have any knowledge that the ability to exercise that option exists elsewhere in rule or statute?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to my knowledge.
Nor to mine. Okay, just confirming. Continue, please.
It removes the provision of lending one's name to or billing on behalf of a legal practitioner. It would only limit this to chiropractic. It would not include other healing arts. So we had a case not too long ago of, we had a doctor of chiropractic who had a unlicensed dentist utilizing his space and practicing outside his space, and he was providing and allowing for services in there. This case, we could not adjudicate under our current statutes. We would have to wait for a conviction before we could move forward and put any sort of practice restrictions on them, anything like that. That would be gone.
And in that regard to that particular case, due in part to the presence of that language, we were able to move forward and effectively protect the public safety, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
It removes all of our improper billing statutes and rules, so we would no longer be able to really address those issues. There would be no requirement for chiropractors to have their specialties certified, such as your PMMTP and your acupuncture certificates, which, as you all know, you require a certain amount of college level or level courses for that. Plus, you have to pass the national exam. The board's job is to certify that the doctor has done so. This just says they have to have the education to perform those. And so part of our responsibility is to protect the public by ensuring that you've met the requirements to conduct and provide those specialties.
Okay, so a patient is harmed due to inappropriate behavior by a specialty practitioner who's not required to be certified, and this would remove our ability to protect the public in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
So if somebody took acupuncture courses as part of their coursework in chiropractic, in chiropractic school, but never passed the exam. How's the public supposed to know that? They've taken the coursework, but they didn't pass the exam. The board certifies that they've met those requirements.
Right. And in the event of an adverse event, or in the event of an adverse consequence to the patient, the board's hands would be tied relative to protecting the public.
Mm-hmm. It removes the treatment protections such as secret means to treat, representing that a manifestly incurable condition can be permanently cured, and prevents the board from requiring the licensee to divulge the means and methods, device, or instruments used to treat that condition. We would know, we'd have no insight into that whatsoever.
Okay.
Also, it would no longer be a violation to not supervise your chiropractic assistant and allow them to provide services without direct supervision. It strikes the direct supervision requirement and reporting and registering those CAs with the board.
Yeah. And, you know, every other mainstream healthcare profession, medical doctors, osteopathic physicians, physical therapists, even, and the list goes on. I cannot think of one mainstream healthcare profession that qualifies for insurance reimbursement, for one thing, but that is regulated by boards for the safety of the public, where they, in every case, there is attendant, this business of attendant to care, where care is provided under the supervision and attended to the scope of the practice of the licensed practitioner that is regulated by the board. Every profession has that. And our profession has attained that through the chiropractic assistant certification program. If I shudder to think of what the impact would be on a potential negative impact on public safety. And it's not our job to advocate for the profession, but as a practitioner, I shudder to think about what the insurance industry would do in the event that the delivery of chiropractic care under the supervision of a chiropractor, but by a non-certified, non-regulatable chiropractic assistant were to go away. And so that's a point of concern.
As soon as the insurance companies get wind of it, they will stop paying for all modalities and procedures.
Yeah, and although that, and I'm glad you made that point, Ms. Powell, because even though it's not our job to advocate for the profession, it's the profession, you know, it's the association, right, and others to advocate for their interests in the world, the loss of the absence of chiropractic care as an available benefit to the public is a threat to the public safety.
I agree.
And especially when we have something in place already.
Mm-hmm.
It also removes some protections such as requiring chiropractors to identify themselves to the public as a DC, doctor of chiropractic, or chiropractic physician. And I think you all can think of cases that we've had recently, especially surrounding social media and website advertising, as properly disclosing your qualifications in these formats. That would no longer be a violation. All of your advertising violations also go away, and the profession markets and brands itself. So that, and then the next part that I found incredibly concerning is the lack of the board's ability to enforce any of its own provisions. So the board would effectively no longer be able to enforce non-disciplinary orders for continuing education, which we utilize to rehabilitate practitioners. And so under this, it's no longer a violation to not comply with a non-disciplinary order for continuing education, meaning the board could recommend in the future continuing ed, but we could not require it nor ensure that the licensee completed it.
Are you finished with that point, or
go ahead.
I just to that point, I'm forgetting who I had this conversation with. Maybe it was one of you, but I've had so many conversations on this subject recently. But if you walk the consequences of all this through, what the net effect of it is that the board is basically stripped of so many options that the only thing there is either dismiss the case or there is revoke the license.
Mm-hmm.
And virtually all of the enforcement of anything else is stripped from the authority with this bill. I can't say absolutely all of it because I haven't looked at every one, but I have looked at many of them, and all of the ones that I looked at are all eliminated. And so we find ourselves in a situation where we have two options: to revoke or to dismiss, and very little else. And this is not only a detriment to public safety, but it's a detriment to those who come before our board who may have made a mistake that needed only a non-disciplinary advisory letter to correct something, where there are so many different options that we very rarely do we find ourselves in a situation where we're revoking. And so it alarms me greatly that we would be in a position of being in a completely arbitrary situation, with no power to use any judgment or volition relative to the administration of what's the appropriate direction needed.
This also removes our ability to, it would no longer be a violation of unprofessional conduct to not comply with a board subpoena, meaning every subpoena, if we reach noncompliance, we would have to go to court to adjudicate. And even then, if they were required to, comply with the subpoena, it still wouldn't be a violation that the board could address. And often the board uses these as examples of the licensee's ability to be regulated. And so this would definitely drive up our costs, because we would have to utilize more of the attorney general's time to manage and adjudicate these cases. Plus it would be incredibly difficult, not to mention the additional timelines in this bill, how we would comply with these timelines when we're in court fighting over subpoenas and getting people to appear and testify. So it would just make it a very much more labor intensive process than what we currently, and we wouldn't have the staff to really fully address that.
So, an example of that might be that we have a practitioner who is in fact causing harm to the public. We require documentation to make that point, you know, compellingly. We subpoena for that information, but there's no compliance. So essentially the doctor's, the perpetrator is not corrected, and there's little or nothing that the board can do about it.
It would no longer be a violation to violate a board order. So if you think about probation orders or interim orders or evaluation orders, there's bad practitioners who are committing the offenses, and you've, out of good faith, sent them to an evaluation to ensure fitness to practice, psychosexual, mental competency, those types of things. They would simply not comply, and there's not anything that you could do to ensure that they're enforced. And if you put a doctor under an interim order for suspension or practice restriction, especially in those cases that we have of sexual misconduct, where we put a chaperone in the room and have requirements in regards to that, if they were not complying, we would have no mechanism to enforce that, because it wouldn't be a violation. It would just simply be, thanks for letting us know. That is a huge concern to patient safety.
It is. And it's part of what I was talking about earlier.
So this would include, the other thing that I forgot to point out in the earlier part is I sent you all the story about imposter doctors. This bill removes the board's statutory violation of impersonating another practitioner or billing under another name. So we would have no mechanism for doctors that are using someone else's name, their license, their name, and providing services. We would have no mechanism to discipline those doctors or take actions or issue cease and desist orders. And if we issued a cease and desist order, there's nothing behind that.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but in conjunction with language that's elsewhere in this proposed legislation, it would be possible for someone a business entity, for example, to hire an out-of-state chiropractor to essentially practice chiropractic in some form in their clinic. But because of the language, we would not be able to investigate or prosecute or discipline a provider in that situation.
Correct. That would be correct.
Yeah. I'm not sure why that's a good thing. I'm pretty sure it's a bad thing.
It removes class 6 felonies as a violation. And as you know, practicing without a license is a class 6 felony. So this would no longer be a violation of unprofessional conduct under this. And misdemeanors also would not be. And often, DUIs are misdemeanors, and often the board utilizes those to help rehabilitate licensees to ensure that they are safe and competent to practice and that substance abuse does not continue and creep over into their practice. We would have no notification. We would not know about that information.
And I'm called to mind a recent case in which there was a plea bargain, no contest plea on 6 class 6 felony aggravated assaults as part of an agreement not to prosecute for multiple complaints of sexual assault. And this was a case that came out of the courts and back to us for potential revocation. It was a clear case that revocation for the safety of multiple victims over years of duration. If this language was in place, we would not have been able, as I understand it, we would not have been able to take the action that we did. Is that correct?
That is correct. That licensee would still be practicing.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Any more points?
Those are my big main points. The only other thing that I did, if you would like me to share, is I went and I took some recent cases within the last 2 years that we have successfully adjudicated and laid them out under this new statute as to whether or not we would be able to adjudicate or address those cases.
I would like you to do that, but I would like to call attention to one other thing that I think is a very important component to this legislation. It's one of those stated concerns, a concern, by the way, that we as a board share, is the amount of time it takes to prosecute cases, and especially the amount of time it takes to prosecute and close serious cases. And we have, in the last, since the change of administration, since our sunset review, I think our record will clearly demonstrate that we have been very, very effective at addressing that issue and done everything that we can to get these cases taken care of as quickly as possible. But in many cases, nonetheless, the time can become longer than any of us want to have happen. And a lot of, I would say clearly the majority of the time, the reason for that is beyond our control because it involves working with other agencies and jurisdictions such that we have to let criminal proceedings happen and complete before it comes back to our board to adjudicate the matter further. Or we are waiting for agencies to provide us with information. And so the idea of imposing a time constraint that is, that makes us have to close a case by a particular time, yet we have to we're limited by factors beyond our control, makes it impossible for that to occur. And then saying, well, then you have to dismiss the case if you haven't gotten it done by X amount of days. That's not a good thing. And then on top of that, the language that is proposed and the argument that's made when that it's in the legislation that's proposed and which we raised this point during our discussion. And we were directed to the fact that, well, within the legislation, you also have the ability to apply for an extension. And if this case is going to last longer, you can apply for an extension according to this language. But in reading the language, what it says is that a number of criteria have to be met. Every criteria has to be met relative to granting of the extension. And the very first criterion is that the person who's being charged has to agree to the extension. And so we are placed, find ourselves in a place, in a position where, and I believe that we're experiencing that currently, with one case that we're dealing with, where the person who's being investigated, the entity who's being investigated, is basically running out the clock and delaying the process by not providing documentation and creating delays and so forth, such that we are not able to move forward with protecting the public and doing our job. And in this scenario, they could just say, just intentionally, with this language, run out the clock, and the case would mandatorily be dismissed due to a lack of granting of an extension. So I just want to make sure that that's on the table in terms of some of the things that we're discussing relative to our heartburn with this language.
And I think it also says that they have to agree to the extension.
They do.
I'm sorry. I thought that's what I said. What did I say?
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that.
I mean, sorry. I may have said something else. I just.
Yeah, well, and I don't, and I'm like, who is the board requesting the extension from? Because the board in this instance is the authority. So who do we go to ask for the, like, does the investigator go to the board and ask the board for the extension? Like, the licensee doesn't have authority over the board.
Yeah. Yeah.
They would.
So it's like, it's very unclear on where we would be going to ask for this extension and how that would be like, do we go to the governor's office? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. Before you lay out some of the cases that we, mm-hmm. I want to just take a moment. Line 40, items 18 through 20 on the deletions of the Unprofessional Practices Act. Also items that are deleted were, the items that say that it's unethical to, let me read the, specific ones here. It would not make it illegal to dispense prescription drugs. It would not make it illegal to perform surgery, excuse me, or practice obstetrics. It would not prohibit the performance of colonic irrigation, all of which are in the statute or the rule currently, and which would be removed by this legislation. So again, as far as I'm concerned, that's not okay.
It also removes the solicitation part of your statutes. So then the cases that I pulled, Dr. Bennett already talked about probably the most recent one where we did revoke a license for multiple cases of pleading guilty to aggravated assault, and those were minor patients, and that did occur in the treatment room. The next case that I wanted to bring to you is 2021-025, and this case was the patient came before us. She had a pre-existing condition, and she stated multiple times to the licensee that she couldn't have her neck adjusted because of her condition, and he offered to allow her to come into the office for an x-ray of her foot. There was no treatment plan. There was no consent sign. There was no documentation. And he took an x-ray. And then during the course, he gave her a tour of his office and offered her the opportunity to lay down on his roller table. And while he was doing that, he said, I've been to this school. I've learned this special treatment. It's helped me. I can help you. And she said, no, I can't have my neck adjusted. And she said it over and over again. He proceeded to offer and put her into traction and proceeded to adjust her neck, which worsened her condition and actually injured her. Under this law, we would not be able to address this case because that's patient injury. That would no longer be a provision that we could address. The other case that I wanted to bring to your attention is 2021 023 and 024. And this one was, I wanted to point out where this bill specifically defines patient safety, but it says it's about patient safety and misconduct and patient injury, yet the the bill completely removes those from the statute, but that administrative cases are not matters of patient safety. But I wanted to point out this case because this was completely an administrative case, but it was about patient safety. This doctor appeared before the board on multiple occasions for a lot of administrative matters, billing concerns that the board had, but also the board identified that this individual, when he came before you for questions, his speech was slurred. He could not follow the conversation. He was having difficulty understanding, being on time for the meetings, those types of like just behavioral things that were concerning to the board. And that in addition, he was also creating treatment plans, collecting cash for those treatments, and then was never able to fulfill the treatments. Like he wasn't in the office or he didn't show up for the appointment, those types of things. And that the board put him under probation and required him to take numerous amount of hours of continuing education, plus get an evaluation on his fitness to practice based on his behavior in the board meetings and the board's concerns about that. The licensee failed to comply with the board order, failed to get the fitness to practice evaluation. And so under the additional violation of failure to comply with a board order or consent agreement, the licensee voluntarily surrendered their license. The other one that I want to point out to you is 2020-026, which in this case, the licensee hypnotized a patient during the treatment, and then while she was unconscious, proceeded to perform oral sex on her. The licensee denied this in the board meeting, and the board, in order to better protect the public, but because we couldn't substantiate the allegations based on the information we had, we issued a disciplinary consent agreement, but part of that was for the licensee to undergo and pass a psychosexual evaluation. And during that evaluation with the polygrapher, he confessed that he did hypnotize and violate the patient. We opened a new complaint for making false or misleading statements to the board because he lied to you during the initial testimony. And because of that, the licensee voluntarily surrendered their license. Under this new law, we'd have no ability, A, to ensure that offenders or practitioners completed their evaluations, and then you'd have no recourse when they violated them. The next one I wanted to point out to you is 2021-003 and 2022-024. This licensee was utilizing and had basically a med spa clinic where he was providing weight loss treatments using red light therapy. However, he was not physically in the practice. He would see the patients telephonically and determine that they met the requirements for the treatment. And then the estheticians that were at the facility would actually provide the procedure, and he provided no oversight. And also, he claimed that he did not own the clinic, that he was only the clinic director, and that under that, the board issued additional subpoenas for financial information to determine the information around the sale. And under this new law, it says that we couldn't subpoena personal financial records. It was the personal financial records and requiring him to provide the documentation of the sale and the transactions and the financial payments that actually compelled him to not fully comply with the subpoena and thereby determine to voluntarily surrender his license. As the board adjudicated that case. The next one is 2018-001. This licensee operated the unlicensed dental clinic, which was determined to be unsanitary and unsafe for patients. We would not be able to issue an interim order for suspension to stop the practice. We would have to wait for the case to be fully adjudicated and him to be convicted of the Class 3 felony. And then the last one is 2019-23, and this licensee was arrested and convicted for videotaping patients in the changing room and bathroom of his practice without consent, without the danger to the health, safety, and welfare to the public. There's no way to adjudicate this because it's not listed as sexual misconduct in our statutes.
Thank you, Ms. Vanderveen. I would also, these are just a few of the highlights of where bad guys did bad things. And I also want to just go on record to talk about, as I mentioned earlier, for every one of these very serious situations where revocation or very, very, you know, long-term probation or whatever is necessary, there are many, many, I would say just in my experience on the board, I've seen more than 100, perhaps more than 200 cases where doctors have come to the board. There's been something amiss, but it does not rise to the level of revocation, but it does need to be fixed. And the doctor fixes it and then gets on with life. And the world is a better place, both for that doctor and for their patients. And that level of correction has been performed. So that, you know, a guy comes in for a parking ticket and he doesn't get executed. That's one of the big concerns that I have that I alluded to earlier, that we have these cases that we talked about, but we also have so many of them where we don't have to exert heavy discipline. We have to do just enough to do what needs to be done to get the public protected with confidence into the future. And our ability to administer that kind of correction is wiped away with the language of this that's proposed.
So just to go with your point, in the last year, in terms of the cases that we adjudicated last year, only 7% of them resulted in revocation or surrender, and 15% resulted in discipline. The other and then the rest, 42% were non-disciplinary actions, and 34% were dismissed.
Yeah.
So, and, to your point.
And just to reinforce what you said, these are statistics and numbers that are reported on. If you've attended a board meeting, you know that these numbers are reported on really ever since about the same time. What was it, 3 years ago or thereabouts, we've had a 200% correction turnover in our staff, including the onboarding of a new director, executive director. And since that time, and 0% turnover since our new team has been in place, we have been monitoring these outcome numbers on a routine basis. And we pay attention to these numbers. And so we are very confident that those numbers can be defended. And the point is that everything is not a dismiss or a revoke. There's a lot in between. And we can't let our doctors down in that way. And we can't let the public down. That said, we have covered a number of points. There are others. That's a lot already. I would like to ask any of my board members, if there are any other points that they noticed in their review of the materials that should be brought to light as well.
Dr. Bennett, I have a question about, let me just get to the document real quick here. It actually allows doctors to practice in this state who are not licensed by this state, which was somewhat disconcerting. It is... on page 815 of the document, line 4, where they struck out license pursuant to this chapter. Am I understanding that you could just be a doctor of chiropractic, graduated school, but not necessarily be licensed?
It would only be in the instance that they were employed by a business entity, but business entities are owned by unlicensed individuals.
Exactly. So you could have an unlicensed chiropractor practicing, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I think that's something that's pretty serious. Let's see. I think you covered most of them, Ms. Vanderveen. Communication. I agree about all those timelines were absurd. Solicitation. Did we discuss solicitation in terms of?
Yes, we did.
Okay. I guess that's about it. I think you hit all the high points.
Okay. Dr. Lees, do you have any comments to make or?
Excuse me. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I forgot about the licensing renewal, the 90 days without any repercussions for not renewing your license. It's on page 7, line 34.
And articulate your concern, please.
Yeah. If the licensee doesn't renew his license on time, he has 90 days to renew it. And then we're supposed to backdate that license 90 days so that I assume this is to cover them under managed care contracts or whatever. I found this really disconcerting because, first of all, it's the doctor's responsibility to keep track of their licensure. I think it's important enough if they forget once in a while, they have to pay a penalty. There's a penalty for anything like that. Every board has that. Why would we want to stricken that? Why would we want to give 90 days to renew when you had all the time up until then to renew? With a new system in place, it seems like this would be it's burdensome to the staff to have to administer this way. And especially going back retroactively. I just think it's unnecessary.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Lees, I'd ask you for your comments, but actually, in light of the time, and I know that Mr. Turbinson has a hard stop in about 9 minutes, Mr. Turbinson, I would ask you first to give you first choice in terms of comments or contributions.
Thank you. I echo Ms. Vanderveen's all of the points she made and all the points others have made. I think a lot of this is, hitting in one end on reducing our ability to move investigations forward quickly, while at the same time, essentially giving an out to licensees to not obey what the board's doing. And so really, I see nothing but a danger to the public in how these revisions are seemingly going to be implemented. But those are the only points I have.
Thank you. And just for the record, what is your profession, sir?
I'm an attorney.
Thank you. very well. Dr. Lees, your turn.
Thank you, Chairman. Part of this is just my being new to the board and still understanding all the different areas we cover. And I certainly agree with majority, if not all, the points have been made. I do have a question. As I understand it, the board doesn't hear billing disputes, but our executive director brought something up about a change in us handling billing. Could you specify what that would be? How that would affect what we're doing currently?
So we would not be able to adjudicate a complaint. Say a patient brought to our attention that they were billed for services not rendered, we would normally address that. And often the board, if they issue disciplinary action, requires restitution to the patient. We would not be able to do that under this.
And if I may, the current statute says that we're not involved in billing disputes. So that means that if somebody comes and says, I want to dispute the billing as a billing practice, that's something we would not take up. But
we wouldn't take up something like X chiropractor charges $100 and this chiropractor charges $125, right? Like those types of, it's more so what isn't in the patient record versus what they were billed or vice versa.
And so it would be within our purview. If the complaint was made relative to something specific to what is identified as unprofessional conduct, if it involved, if in proceeding with that process, it involved subpoenaing Billing to make the point or to, you know, establish whether it did or did not occur. then it would be within our, jurisdiction to proceed in looking at Billing records and so forth, but we would not be prosecuting relative to it as a Billing dispute, which actually, if it brings to mind, there's another issue that, should add to the list. And that is the requirement with regard to requesting records. The existing statute says that you can verbally request records or you can request them in writing. And I believe that the proposal is that the written request be taken away.
It would just be a verbal request. You are correct.
Yeah. And so we get into a situation, and I see board members shaking their heads, where it becomes a he said, she said. Well, you know, who says you got the request? Well, I say I got the request. Well, it was a verbal. I mean, we get into the situation where we're just not able to find the facts and don't have a baseline of behavior. So that's just another thing to add to the list. Dr. Lees, are you comfortable with what you said?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay, good. Thank you. And Dr. Camacho, our newest arrival, what would you have to say about all of this?
Well, first of all, you know, I got certified in acupuncture and modalities of physical therapeutic adjunctive therapy, in the late 80s and early 90s. And it cost me some money to have to drive to Phoenix. So they don't have the opportunity of online like that now. So I went to Phoenix quite a few times and had to spend the night quite a few times. And, you know, I paid a decent amount of money to get what I have now. I mean, for somebody to walk in and just say, look, we'll just show you how to put a couple of points on somebody for low back pain, and then you don't have to be licensed. I mean, it's just ludicrous. And in the first place, this person could commit an injury to a patient, and it's basically violating the patient's health in that sense. So we'd have to look at that. Another thing I'd like to know is what time on Tuesday is this going to be heard, and can we go in there and give our opinion on this and
respond? Yes, absolutely. It's 1:30 on Tuesday.
Yeah, and because in being sensitive to, again, to Mr. Turbinson's timeline, I want to invite all of the board members to attend the hearing. We are on the agenda. It begins at 1:30. That agenda, in my experience, having been to quite a number of these hearings, it almost never starts at that time. So when you come, plan on spending time there, waiting for our turn to come up. But okay. I would ask, in fact, I may have individual conversations with board members as we develop a position statement, but I would ask each of you to consider being present at the time. And if you do, I would encourage you also to request to speak and to make a point. And Ms. Vanderveen will be available to help you in that process as well.
Okay, good. Now, is Mr. Turbinson is the one going to be doing some of this main statements or something regarding?
Yes, he's going to carry the ball completely. No.
In case we forgot.
I'm sorry, I just needed to see the look on your face before you left, Mr. Turbinson. Board staff, I will be presenting. There will be other people representing the board's position and supporting the board's position as well. But it is best to hear directly from the board members themselves.
Okay.
Since we're running out of time and Mr. Turbinson does need to leave, the one thing I think we need to walk out of this meeting is a position if we are going to support the bill or oppose the bill, because that opens up strategic avenues that we can leverage once we take
very
a
well.
Position.
Yeah. And respecting that, we'd like got like 60 seconds here. And I would like to, if possible, have a unanimous vote. So I would like to entertain a motion to either support, remain neutral on, or oppose this proposed legislation.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to oppose this legislation.
Okay, it's been moved. Is there a second?
I second it.
There's been a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of opposing this legislation signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Okay, the vote is unanimous. We will adopt a position of opposition. And in the time we have remaining, as schedule permitting, we still have a quorum. And so we will kind of organize these thoughts and consider our options and direct board staff to prepare a position statement that we'll make available by the most expedient means to the various people that should be exposed to this information. So thank you, Mr. Turbinson, for taking the time.
Thank you.
That said, I would like to entertain a motion to move an executive session for legal advice.
I'll make the motion, Mr. Chairman, to move into executive session for legal advice.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Dr. Lees is the second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, okay. Give us 2 seconds to set up the room and okay, we'll move everybody.
By the same sign. Okay, hearing none, please. Yeah, we'll take a brief break while the board sets up the virtual room for executive session. And let the record show that the break began at 2:00. Are we now ready to proceed?
We are. We are back in the regular meeting, and I would just like to note for the record that that Dr. Camacho has left the meeting and Mr. Turbinson, but we still have quorum.
Thank you. I was going to ask that very question before I reconvene, but thank you for doing that. It's 2:25. We will reconvene at this time and confirm that a quorum is in fact present. During the executive session, we reviewed legal matters relative to what is appropriate in discussion of cases and what legal rules exist relative to our dialogue when we present at the hearing and the briefing of board members with regard to how that would be navigated and so forth. So just in, by way of general transparency, I just want to cover that. Now, we have a list. There are more items on the list, but at this point, it's not necessary to review in greater granular detail everything else on that list that we have difficulty supporting. We had a vote that the board unanimously will oppose this, and the question now becomes how do we manage how we will present this information and our opposition to the Senate Health Committee on Tuesday's hearing. My thoughts, and I would like to hear from everyone with regard to this, board and staff. My thought is we have a list. We kind of have a general consensus on what the priorities are on those lists. It's still a lengthy list. And so I would throw out the idea that instead of providing any interested party, a legislator, a lobbyist, a regulator, somebody from the governor's office, whomever, a multi-page document that requires reading all the way through, that we instead endeavor to provide them with an executive summary of key points of concern and then reference an attached list of specific statutory language. And that seems to be an expedient way of doing this if we really have the expectation in a very limited amount of time, we can get this document read and absorbed by the important parties. So what are your thoughts relative to that idea?
I'm in full agreement. I thought that maybe I got it down to like two paragraphs.
Really? Wow. Okay. So is it, go ahead and give us your two paragraphs.
SB 1233 is a bill that claims to protect patient safety. However, it seems to do the exact opposite. This bill strikes several statutory violations and unprofessional conduct rules that aim to protect patients and hold healthcare providers accountable for their actions. This bill eliminates 26 statutory violations and unprofessional conduct rules, which are essential for ensuring patient safety. Examples of these changes are malpractice resulting in death or injury of a patient, providing substandard care through intentional action or neglect, and any conduct or practice that poses a threat to the safety of the health welfare of the public. In addition, the bill removes critical enforcement protections that leaves the board without means to enforce its statutes, regulations, board orders, or consent agreements. It also eliminates all of the board's improper billing and advertising rules, which are designed to ensure clear and accurate billing and marketing from its licensees. This has led to concerns that the bill prioritizes healthcare providers' interests over patient safety and well-being.
So I like that, but I think there should be another paragraph.
Okay. I'm all in.
And I didn't prepare that paragraph because I've been formulating it as we've been having our dialogue here, but I think it should say something like this. The changes proposed in this legislation are highly inconsistent or incongruent to similar statutory and rule language in allied healthcare professions, both within our state and throughout the United States. Additionally, these revisions are also inconsistent with recognized authoritative model practice documents, such as the Model Practice Act, Chiropractic Model Practice Act, as promulgated by the Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Boards, whose service area includes all states of the United States, all Canadian provinces, and multiple additional foreign countries. How was that for the first run through?
Not bad.
Hey, Tom, Dr. Leese, do you have any comments on that, language?
I think it sounds great. I agree with you. I think brevity is very important just because of the timeline that we're working with. So the more concise we can be, the better.
Ms. Powell?
I'm sorry, you said mute. It's perfect. I think one of the phrases you were searching for was generally accepted.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, that's good.
Got it.
We do want to keep it as short and directly on point as possible. Easy reading.
And perhaps a final line, one line paragraph, say, see attached list for specific yes, questionable or controversial or inappropriate language.
Or contradictory.
I assume you've got something very close to that.
And I'll just go back to, I'll just take the audio and transcribe it.
Okay. So then, are we comfortable because of the urgent nature of this? I mean, we need to get this document completed by the end of the day today and mm-hmm. distributed by first thing Monday morning, if not the end of the day today, which is like mm-hmm. 3 hours from now. Less than 3 hours from now. So With that in mind, I'd like to entertain a motion to authorize board staff to proceed with the distribution of the document that they've drafted based upon our input, and to distribute that document to the appropriate parties.
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chairman, to instruct the staff to put together this document in accordance with the outcome of this meeting and to circulate it as appropriate.
Good. And is there a second?
A second.
Thank you, Dr. Lees. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? Hearing none, the ayes have it, a unanimous 3-0 vote with 2 absent. Okay. Ms. Vanderveen, are you aware of anything else that needs to be addressed relative to this one item agenda?
No, I don't have any other items.
All right. Then as the last agenda item, we will now have a call to the public. This is a virtual meeting.
Oh, there's actually, the agenda doesn't have a call to the public.
Oh, great. That's fine with me. Then that said, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Make a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Is there a second?
I second.
And second and moved. All those in favor, any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed by the same sign. Hearing none. We are standing adjourned with unanimous vote. Thank you, all of you, for taking your time and devoting the attention that we have required of you to this urgent matter. We'll talk to you later. Thanks. And thanks to staff, too.